Welcome back to our series coming from the Critical Care Canada Forum in lovely Toronto. Welcome to another one of our fellows, Andrea Davenport. Thanks for joining us on the ones and twos. Thank you from me, Peter Brindley, and Leon Baker. But most importantly, our guest is the magnificent professor of medicine here at Toronto, Eddie Phan. We're going to talk about all things ECMO. We've done, 25, 30 episodes, and we haven't yet done, in quotation marks, ECMO. This is wrong. Eddie, thank you for helping us deal with this deficit.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you. Now, my knowledge on ECMO fits nicely on the back of a postage stamp. Why do you think we invited a trainee along? I'm going to turn this over to Andrea for the opening question.
Nice to meet you, Dr. Phan. One of the things I was wondering is, as a trainee, we have an introduction to ECMO throughout our training, but was wondering if you have any quick tips and tricks for fellows who might hit the ground running in a CVICU, and what are some things that we should look out for?
Well, I think, you know, like many things in the ICU in general, our focus is still on the patient. And I mean, that's probably the key message here, is that sometimes with all this gadgetry, we're all drawn towards what the patient's connected to, the different life support devices. But I think really the centering piece here is the patient. So my advice to you is that ECMO's, in the end, no difference than a ventilator, a dialysis machine, a balloon pump, some life support device that your patient would be connected to. But at the end of the day, start at the patient and work your way back from there. So that would be the big advice, because sometimes what happens is that something is going wrong, patient's blood pressure is low, the saturation is low, it's something is evolving in a way that you don't feel is correct, and everybody gravitates towards the machine and nobody's looking at the patient. So start with the patient and then work your way backwards.
Makes sense. Don't lose track of the basics.
Exactly.
But this also sounds like we're going to lead into a broader discussion, not just how do you troubleshoot, how do you become competent, but who should be, who shouldn't be, when do you start, how do you stop? So Leon?
Well, I mean, yes, start with the basics, start with the patient, sound advice, but let's be honest, ECMO certainly is a different beast. It's not, you know, part of our general training necessarily, and I think many centers treat it as almost a subspecialty device. Let's get back to some of the basics, if that's okay. The evidence behind it. Is there anything beyond Caesar and Eolia at this time?
Yeah, I think at this time, that's the best evidence we have for patients with severe acute respiratory distress syndrome or ARDS. Caesar and Eolia really are two major modern randomized control trials. So that's our best data. We have lots of observational data now from these two pandemics that have passed, first the H1N1 and now COVID-19. That's also lends support for the use of ECMO in these severe patients. But really, I think when you look at the totality of the data, what's become increasingly clear is that for patients that meet the inclusion criteria of the Caesar trial or Eolia, ECMO has a benefit in those patients. And I would say that, again, in 2023, that's now reflected by a strong recommendation for its use in the European guidelines for the management of ARDS patients. And then just today at the Canada Critical Care Forum, the updated ATS guidelines also have a recommendation for the use of ECMO in these patients.
So give us those indications. Sorry to jump in.
Yeah, no problem. So it's basically, again, these trials were in adults, so I won't be speaking about pediatrics or kids, but basically an adult over 18 with a severe, acutely reversible cause of respiratory failure, typically meeting a criteria of severe hypoxemia, so typically a PF ratio less than 80, or difficulty maintaining an adequate pH or ongoing respiratory acidosis while being maximally ventilated, so that you would have to like turn over to injurious levels of mechanical ventilation. So typically those criteria would be a pH of less than 7.25 with a CO2 over 60, despite, again, optimized mechanical ventilation. So if you're in these sort of trouble areas and you're doing everything you can with all the other evidence-based therapies that we have, including prone positioning, low tidal volume ventilation, deep sedation, paralysis, probably a trial of higher PEEP, then, and you don't have any contraindications, then ECMO would be indicated.
Right. How soon do you want to hear from us?
You know, that's the usual thing. Sooner the better, right? Mm-hmm. So I think maybe not the patient who gets onto a couple liters nasal prongs, and maybe not when the patient is already near unfortunately, the end game. But I think, again, it's good to create relationships. If you're in a center that doesn't have ECMO, it's to figure out where your referral center would be, create that relationship, so that hub and spoke relationship. And with that relationship in place, feel free to bounce those patients, you know, refer early, have discussions, run the management plan, you know, have contingencies for if things work the way you want them to, if they don't, that sort of thing. I think calling early is always better.
Yeah. Again, we're back to the relationship thing, isn't it? It's the magic thread.
Yeah.
So if I understand correctly, there's essentially ventilation issues or oxygenation issues. And so traditionally, or what I've been taught in the past, is that the hypoxemia needs to be described sort of very, very specifically. And it's not only the PF ratio, but it's also duration. Is that still the case? Is it still a PF ratio of 80 or less for 3 hours versus 100 for 6 hours type of thing? And I may be butchering the numbers here, but...
No, you're absolutely right. So those criteria, they're actually quite old. Like in the very original trial from 1979, they had these fast and slow entry criteria, right? So yeah, you either develop very severe hypoxemia fast in the first 3 hours, or maybe slightly less severe hypoxemia, but it was persisting over 6 hours. I think I think in 2023 now, we sort of extrapolated a bit to say that essentially if you've got severe ARDS with a PF ratio less than 80, if that's the criteria we're looking at, hypoxemia, then as long as that's persistent, obviously we don't want to put someone on to ECMO if they're hypoxemic, you know, sort of a dip for an hour or two, but basically you've got persistent hypoxemia with a PF that's durably less than 80, again, despite all the other things that we can do, then that's the kind of patient that we're looking at for ECMO.
But let's talk about the ventilation at that point. Would this then mean that you have to be on an FR2F1?
Again, not necessarily. I think this is the importance of having that conversation with your referral center, because sometimes it's also the trajectory that we're talking about, how quickly people have worsened. And again, we all experienced that in COVID-19. We started to see a pattern in certain patients where you saw them deteriorate quite quickly. So again, we might, you know, preemptively at least maybe transfer patients to an ECMO center, if not put them onto ECMO, if we really saw that we knew where the writing was going to be on the wall in 2 or 3 hours. And there's no sense in intervening when you've crossed the event horizon of darkness. So again, sort of depends.
So I think this is a great discussion. We're getting there. If I can be controversial, just to keep people listening, I guess. Rationing comes from the same etymologic origin as rational. In other words, it isn't always unreasonable to not do something. Now, one of the things that rations ECMO is a perfusionist or a bed, rather than just the cost of the machine, the supplies. Here goes the polemic. I wonder one day if Silicon Valley is going to pick up on how to reverse engineer these things, mass produce these things, and then cost will actually be removed from the equation as well. Do we, as a profession, have the insight to properly select ration and match the right treatment to the right patient, and certainly for the right duration? I'm probably leading into Andrea's next question.
I guess the thing that I've heard a lot of people questioning too has been, when is the correct time to stop ECMO in patients, and what are the criteria that you look at to say someone's ready for that?
So Eddie, if you could just quickly answer all of those questions, okay?
Yeah, no problem. If you want to buy my book. So I think these are all great questions. And again, I think, you know, the important thing to recognize that, at least at the moment, for the current evidence base that we have for ECMO, it's really in these very severe ARDS patients. And again, like from epidemiologic data, it's a small number of patients, right? It's maybe like 10% or less of ARDS patients that typically present with very refractory hypoxemia or have these very challenged, you know, very durable challenges of ventilation. So I don't think outside of a pandemic situation, there necessarily would be an explosion in the need. So even if we had more machines, you're absolutely right. Probably the biggest capital that we have is the health human resources. Those are typically limiting. Maybe the good news on the ECMO front is that things are becoming simpler in terms of its use. Like even in our program, like some other large programs around the world, like at the Glenfield Hospital in the UK or centers like Columbia in New York, we've really gone to a nurse-led model of ECMO, right? So the nurses are trained, the circuits are simplified, and perfusion or ECMO specialists come by on an as-needed basis. So that's one thing that sort of simplifies things. But again, outside of a pandemic situation, I don't see at the current time an explosion in the use of ECMO, at least for respiratory indications. In terms of the stopping, I would say agreed. I think, and again, this is a question that plagues us in the ICU, not just for ECMO as a device, but obviously all the kinds of life support and aggressive care that we provide in the ICU. At some point, we need to reevaluate if we're providing goal concordant care and if we can get the patient, importantly, to their goal. If we can't get them to their goal, it kind of doesn't make a lot of sense to continue the things that we're doing. So having a good understanding of that and discussion with the patient and their substitute decision maker is important. But COVID also taught us that the lung has a tremendous ability to recover. So the interesting thing is that around the world, patients who had severe COVID-19 and got into ECMO, the ECMO runs were very much longer. And I think much to the surprise of many ECMO practitioners is that if you waited long enough, these patients weren't getting complications. They were sort of stable, if you will, on ECMO, that at 60 days, 90 days, 100 days, there's actually sufficient lung recovery in the absence of complications to come off ECMO. So I think what we're starting to learn is that in the right patients, the lung has this, tremendous ability to recover. So it's not so easy to determine, I think. And maybe it's a bit easier when the patient, the lung is, not only is the lung not recovering, but there's worsening multi-organ failure or that sort of thing. I think signs that we could realize that things are not moving in the right direction. But in terms of a single organ failure of the lung, it's actually has a pretty good ability to recover.
It's interesting that, you know, people can be on ECMO circuits for that long. That brings me back again to sort of inclusion criteria or who you want to see. Is there a cutoff for duration of ventilation after which there's no good evidence that it will be helpful?
Yeah, so this is the interesting thing. And again, it's probably less an arbitrary cutoff, although the trials used one to operationalize this. So the two trials used a mechanical ventilation of less than 7 days. Mm-hmm. We have some observational data, both in adults and some from pediatrics, that suggest even longer, there's still a benefit, maybe up to 10 to 14 days seems to be, you know, not particularly an increase. But again, at the end of the day, it's pretty arbitrary to say that a person on day 15 is no longer a candidate and a person on day 13 and a half is a great candidate, as an example. So I think it really depends on the situation and what the duration of mechanical ventilation is trying to capture. Again, is this idea that if you've been receiving antibiotics, anti-inflammatory sort of things directed at the underlying etiology of your respiratory failure, and if anything on good supportive care, you continue to get worse, then really you have to ask yourself the question, like, you've had all this stuff, what will putting you on ECMO do on day 12 that you haven't already received or tried? Like, is the underlying process really reversible? And that's really what that number, whatever it might be, is trying to capture.
So it's got everything to do with your chances of having a successful ECMO run versus perhaps ventilator-induced lung injury or something like that.
Exactly, because at the end of the day, the other important thing to remember is that ECMO is not a treatment for anything.
Yeah.
ECMO is exactly like the ventilator. It's a support strategy to help provide a bridge or time for either your own body to heal itself or for you to give some therapies that hopefully will take time to heal the lung and then see how it goes. Yeah.
So while we're talking about arbitrary criteria, next comes age. How long is a piece of string? And then next comes, we'll put him on VV ECMO, but not VA ECMO. Would you mind speaking to those chestnuts?
Yeah. So age, again, agreed. It's arbitrary. In the trials, they operationalize things by providing an age. Again, we're talking about adult trials. So age 18, and Caesar, I think, had an upper limit of 65. Just again, to operationalize in the trial. I think it's, again, very challenging from an ethical point of view to say that there's a specific age cutoff for ECMO. And really, when we're talking about age, because it's not chronologic age that we're interested in, although chronologic age captures a lot of what we're talking about, which is like the physiologic age, right?
Right.
So then with increasing chronologic age, that typically comes with more comorbidities, perhaps more frailty, chronic health problems that, again, lead to the challenges of having a successful ECMO run. So but really what we want to do is not so much think about the chronologic age of the patient, but their physiologic age in terms of thinking about the strategy. And then in terms of Peter's good question about changing configuration, again, I would say that's probably less an idea of I'm going to put you on one kind of ECMO versus another, but really the underlying reasons why you would consider that. So the fact that you put them on a support strategy like VV ECMO because they've got severe ARDS, and then the wheels start to fall off because now they're going into more multi-organ failure. Now they had hemodynamic compromise, myocardial depression, maybe other organ failure. So then the idea is not so much that we couldn't put you on VA ECMO or some cardiac support in addition to the respiratory support, but really thinking about, you know, is this more a sign that things are moving in the wrong direction? And again, would adding additional organ support actually lead to a meaningful outcome, or we're just doing things because we can do them? So that's really the underlying question there.
And that kind of leads into my next question. And that is one really of equity and access to this treatment. You know, I mean, and I guess I really mean geographical access. You know, we're one of the biggest countries in the world. And I imagine somebody living up north versus a big center like Toronto, there's definitely equity and access issues. How do you approach that?
Yeah, this is, I think, a major issue because, again, our goal is to provide the same access to the same kind of healthcare for every Ontarian, just as an example.
Of course.
Since I work here in Ontario, and our land area is huge. Like, the land area of Ontario is larger than the land area of France. So it's very challenging to get to patients in the north, and I bet you a lot of referring centers there don't even know about ECMO. They wouldn't know to pick up the phone. If a person had severe influenza, as an example, up there, and they were doing very poorly, they probably wouldn't know necessarily to call an ECMO center to make a referral. So one is that working with Critical Care Services Ontario and the provincial government, we're trying to get the message out there across the province to understand, you know, who the same questions you guys are asking. Who would be candidates? When should we call? When can we refer, and how would we do that? Second is that we're working closely with transportation agencies, because we need the ability to transport these sick patients to centers, which unfortunately at the moment are pretty much distributed in the southern part of the province, but we need to expand capacity a bit to meet the geographic needs, but also the transportation capacity to get Ontarians who need the therapy to come to centers in southern Ontario where they can get that therapy.
Well, thank you for mentioning transport teams, because that's a lovely segue into my next question. What are your thoughts on these ECMO, these crash ECMO transport teams or cannulation teams flying out specialists there, putting patients on ECMO and bringing them in?
Simple questions, right, Eddie?
It's okay. I'm taking cash for this, right? So transport teams, before COVID-19, actually, about 30% of our ECMO volume at Toronto General was actually going out for mobile cannulation. And again, part of that we recognize is this idea that we need to get the message out there a bit better, because we were getting referrals for some patients. Maybe they had waited a bit longer, so they were too sick to be transported safely without ECMO being put on first and then transported back. And then, of course, there are a small number of patients who just crash and burn, unfortunately, right? So it wasn't that they called late, but literally showed up in the emergency department, and within hours, they had this precipitous deterioration. So we think it's very helpful, again, to provide equitable access, because again, if they're good candidates for the intervention, but they just can't be transported, we want to be able to provide that service. And again, we have some data, especially from centers in France or in Paris, where they have quite a few ECMO programs, even in the metropolitan area of Paris, and a very sophisticated transport system called the SAMU, you might have heard of before, where they actually have critical care emergency physicians embedded with their paramedic service, and they can bring their ECMO teams to other hospitals, referring center. You might have seen these dramatic photos of them cannulating people in the Louvre and all this sort of stuff. So it's really, and so we don't have that kind of service available here, but we can certainly get to referring hospitals if the right patients are there, and again, to provide the therapy that they need and bring them safely back to an ECMO center to get their ongoing management.
Now, Eddie, we're recording from the CCCCF in Toronto, and I remember many years ago hearing Giles Peaks present CESAR here from the Glenfield in Leicestershire. One of the intriguing things that came out of that was not just the benefit of ECMO, but actually the benefit of being in a center that saw enough volume of ARDS. One of the hammers in their toolbox was ECMO, but overall there was a general competence in looking after the disease. Where is that state of play? What is the volume-based competency? Because I think it feeds into the northern center that doesn't even think about ECMO, and it might feed into the secondary, tertiary rather than quaternary center that manages people with bad lung disease, may not even call it ARDS, or if they do call it ARDS, oh, it's pronum flippum, what else do I do? Do I even call the big city?
Yeah, I think, again, so I think it's not hard to imagine that there's this volume outcome relationship with some of these complex interventions like mechanical ventilation, ECMO surgery, trauma care. We know there's quite a few examples in medicine of this situation. And part of it is, again, seeing the case volume or gaining that experience for the whole team that is required to take care of these very sick and complex patients. So again, I don't think it's from my point of view, rocket science that there's a volume outcome relationship. If I need a cholecystectomy tomorrow, I'd want to go to a surgeon who does it 1,000 times, not someone who lasted one 5 years ago. And I think it's the same for ECMO or mechanical ventilation. So I think, agreed. I think it's clear, even outside of this ECMO discussion, that some of these centers that are more remote, maybe have less experience with cases of severe respiratory failures you're discussing, Peter, that they, again, it's a referral network, right? So it's not necessary that all paths lead to the ECMO center, but again, they might increase the intensity of what they can get by going to a secondary, as you mentioned, or a tertiary center first to do the things that maybe are not easy, like proning, inhaled pulmonary vasodilators, if you need that as a rescue therapy, or some other things that they're just more used to at those centers before they get to an ECMO center, or if it's very clear that the patient is already an extremis at the smaller referring center, that they might go directly to the ECMO center.
And we've talked a lot about relationships in a variety of podcasts. It is a reminder that when we get on the phone grumpy at 2 o'clock in the morning and we say, why are you calling me? I don't have any beds. It really does clash with the message of call us early, we're always there to help, et cetera, et cetera. And you can see why those peripheral sites get a bit cheesed off with us after a while. Andrea.
I guess my next question also centers around relationships too, and really around the relationships with the patient's families. So I know we're not the most patient specialty, and we, as well as patient families, may expect to see quick changes in patients. And so jumping to that patient who is in the ICU on ECMO, who's potentially we're waiting 60 days for possible recovery, how do you frame those conversations with surrogate decision makers and other family members?
Yeah, I think, again, this is important, you know, ECMO being a special situation, but in any patient that comes to the ICU, I think which the key thing is to keep the lines of communication open, right? And I think, again, at least in my ICU, when families are available to be on rounds, that's a great way for them to get daily updates, ask questions, understand what the plan of the healthcare team is for their loved one. And that provides, you know, I think a good strategy to keep them reassured as to what's going on. But the good news, Andrea, is I would say, again, the vast majority of patients actually get better sort of in the 7 to 14 day range. So a lot of them are not going the 60 or more days or the sort of ultra long run. So many of them get better quickly. But again, I think the key thing is that message I often use to ICU patients is that if patients are getting better, they're getting better. And sometimes it's actually easier to see the patients who are not getting better and to understand why that's happening. So I think it's just to keep the lines of communication open for the family to help them understand what we're doing to give their loved ones the best chance of getting better, but also to be completely honest with them when things are not moving in the right direction.
Eddie, you mentioned the concentration of these types of patients, you know, to sort of match the skill. And there's obviously very good reasons for that. You also mentioned earlier that during the COVID pandemic, that was not necessarily the case and that you saw ECMO in different or smaller centers, perhaps smaller, maybe being the wrong word. But what do we do for the next pandemic? Are we prepared? Do we have a expansion ECMO plan? Is it even feasible?
Well, it's a good question. I think at least we've learned a lot from this past pandemic. And I would even say that even though it seems a little bit, receding in the rearview mirror, at least for the big numbers that we saw for those few years, I think we learned a lot and we're still digesting what the best planning strategy would be.
Yeah.
So I think what we learned is that, again, keeping in constant communication with the other ECMO centers in the province so that we could load share. And that was very important. So we were all on weekly meetings, if not chatting with each other, you know, electronically through email or text messaging to understand and really to help have central provincial coordination to, again, move patients around to the locations where they could get the care that they needed. But I think the good news is, again, the real limiting resource in the pandemic situation is the health human resources. Like we had enough ECMO machines.
Yeah.
Tubing, disposables, all the stuff that Peter had said, that wasn't the limiting factor. Yeah. Of course, the limiting factor was getting all the skilled nurses, perfusionists, doctors, residents, surgeons, you know, we needed all those people to help support the care of these patients, which is what was the limiting factor in the pandemic.
We've talked solely about ECMO, by which I think most people will assume VA or VV. What about VADs? What happened to Novalung? What else is out there?
Yeah, I mean, so Novalung, you know, was a Health Canada approved device for CO2 removal, sort of less ECMO than it was mainly for CO2 removal. That device actually, the disposable parts of that device are actually no longer available on the market. So we really don't have that as an option. We actually have another Health Canada approved CO2 removal device called the Hemolung. But again, it's a little bit challenging at the moment to get disposals for that. I think most centers that are trying to run to do CO2 removal, say in a patient with an asthma exacerbation or COPD exacerbation, are really using sort of full-blown ECMO systems at less flow, sort of to mimic a CO2 removal device. But that's a good strategy, again, in patients who are mainly having hypercapnia, not a lot of hypoxemia. VADs are a completely different beast, right? So a VAD is really not, for most intents and purposes, a temporary device. We're talking of a more durable device, although there are obviously temporary configurations of VADs that could be used. And again, I think, and if we're talking about a pandemic, I can't at the moment imagine a situation where we might be considering the more widespread deployment of something like a VAD. But certainly, like, we do have patients who, if they're on VA ECMO support for a cardiac problem, say like a viral myocarditis, which did happen in COVID-19 as an example, that some of those patients, if they were good candidates to be considered for something like a lung transplant or needed more time, they might graduate from VA ECMO to a VAD as a either temporary device or even a destination device, but maybe also as a way to bridge patients who are candidates to heart transplantation.
Leon, save that sound clip for later in case we need it. Very quickly, special populations. So bridge to transplant and ECPR.
Yeah.
ECPR. Relatively... I wasn't going to go there, but sorry.
Yeah, well, it's only a 25-minute podcast.
Yeah, I don't know. I might have to run before that conversation. No, but yeah, so bridge to transplant, again, like outside of a pandemic situation, you know, in our center, which is a big lung transplant center and a heart transplant center, ECMO is a very effective way of bridging patients to transplant. I think what we've seen is that on ECMO, with very good support, we can get these chronic respiratory failure patients awake, sometimes off the ventilator. They could be doing early rehabilitation to get them in the best possible shape for transplant. So we think it's a very good modality. In fact, most of our strategy for patients that we identify as transplant candidates and that we want to bridge them, we sort of almost immediately put them on ECMO now. We really want to minimize the time they're on mechanical ventilation, which typically comes with sedation and bed rest and all these other things that, again, accrue morbidity for them if they make it to the transplant and sort of decrease the ability to have a really good outcome from transplant. ECPR is a major beast.
I love how you inhaled before delivering the answer. Nicely.
Well, have no drinks here, so that's all I could do.
Well,
ECPR, the interesting thing is the literature around ECPR is exploding, right? So we've had a number of high-profile randomized control trials this past year about ECPR with really conflicting results. So really not clear at the moment how robust the mortality benefit could be from ECPR. A lot of this depends on things that we touch on, center experience, operator experience with ECPR. There would need to be a whole system level reorganization of getting patients to centers to get ECPR, because time is muscle and time to ECPR is going to be critical. So I think it's something the province is aware of, at least here in Ontario. It's something we've been discussing, but at the moment we're trying to focus more on, again, your original questions, deploying ECMO more equitably across the province for indications that we currently have high level and high quality evidence for, like respiratory failure. We're also starting to think about it for cardiogenic shock, so via ECMO. And then eventually, if we can optimize the delivery of those modalities, then maybe ECPR could be the logical next step. But I wouldn't suggest that ECPR be the starting point for a system that's trying to, you know, have a robust ECMO OS program.
Yeah, ECPR, completely different beast, isn't it? Eddie, thank you so much for joining us. You've certainly answered all my burning questions. We really appreciated you coming on the show, and thanks for a wonderful conference here.
Fabulous. Thanks for doing that.
Oh, no, thanks for doing that.
The health information offered on the Critical Care Commute podcast and the resources available for download through the podcast and show notes is provided for general informational and educational purposes only. It is not intended as a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. The opinions expressed by the hosts, guests, or any individuals featured on this podcast are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the hosts or their employers.